For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, well, tonight we're thinking about worldview, the worldview issue. And when we start here, we want to ask the pertinent question, what is a worldview? Well, not to be condescending, but a worldview is a way of viewing the world. Some people say, I don't have a worldview. Well, yes, you do. By virtue of the fact that you're in the world and that you're viewing the world, you have, by default, a worldview. It's natural for humans to try and capture all of the different sensory data and information into a solidifying world and life view. Really, when we study the subject of worldview, the most dangerous worldviews that we have are those which are not argued for, those which are not given evidence for, but those which are merely assumed. You know, in our culture, many people just assume certain worldviews. It's just the air that they breathe. But unfortunately, ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have victims. And so the air that they're breathing is really asphyxiating many people because of a faulty worldview. Moreover, when we think about the subject of worldview, I'd like to contend that a solid worldview doesn't answer all the questions. We don't have such a thing as exhaustive knowledge. But a solid worldview answers the core questions about reality and the human condition. So while every worldview is going to have questions, even the biblical worldview, there's definitely mystery, things that aren't revealed, that are concealed. And yet at the core, you want to find a worldview that at the core is rock solid. We should further point out that no worldview has absolute certainty. Even Richard Dawkins, the famous notorious atheist, said that on a scale of 1 to 7 of whether or not he believes that there is no God, 7 being, you know, absolute certainty, he says, I'm a 6. So no worldview is absolutely certain, and I respect him for that, to say that he's absolutely certain that there is no God, or someone who believes that there is. What we'd want to say is that we have very good reasons to believe. And in fact, when you have a constellation of reasons and evidence, this actually bolsters your belief, your knowledge, your trust in a particular worldview. When you think about choosing your worldview in the public square of ideas, we need to be careful that not with regard to the evidence, but our own personal biases and skepticism. It's very possible that as human beings, our own background and biases and skepticism can actually color or alter or eclipse the evidence that is out there. Let me give you an example. Harriet Hall from Skeptic Magazine wrote this. She said, what might count as evidence and in context for a miracle? She said, what if a chicken started speaking English, learned to read, and beat a grandmaster in chess? Well, yeah, I would say that would be pretty good grounds for a miracle. But she goes on to say, if we had evidence like that, everyone would be forced to provisionally conclude, not to conclude, but to provisionally conclude, not necessarily that a miracle had occurred. A talking chicken who beats chess masters, not that that is a miracle, but that something had happened that was well outside the ordinary course of events and was impossible to explain without appealing to supernatural forces. It's like she just couldn't quite say the word miracle there. She has to say, well, it's provisional. We couldn't quite conclude. It's supernatural. But wait, we don't really know. It's interesting. Richard Dawkins was interviewed by philosopher, atheistic philosopher Peter Boghossian, and he had this to say about this subject.
What would it take for you to believe in God?
Well, I used to say it would be very simple. It would be, the second coming of Jesus or a great big, deep, booming bass, Paul Robeson voice. Saying, I am God and I created. A non-supernatural second coming could be aliens from outer space. I mean, a superhuman, but not supernatural.
So that couldn't be enough. So what would persuade you?
Well, I'm starting to think nothing would. Which in a way goes against the grain, because I've always paid lip service to the view that a scientist should change his mind when evidence is forthcoming. The trouble is, I can't think what that evidence would look like.
Nothing could persuade you that God exists. See, I don't have respect for that. I think we should be open-minded to other worldviews. So I would put this question to you tonight. Are you an open-minded person? Like, are you one of these people that is just so closed-minded, dogmatic, you wouldn't even count in somebody else's perspective? Or are you the type of person who's exploring and trying to figure out what it is that you believe on your particular spiritual journey? Well, if you're so closed-minded you can't even consider other evidence, I have nothing for you here tonight. The problem isn't with the evidence, there's a psychological issue with you. And I don't say that to be pejorative. I mean, I've been in that state myself, where even though when you're in an argument with somebody, they can be piling on the evidence and you're just so locked down and stubborn you can't give in. However, if you're open-minded enough to hear the evidence, I think you'll at the very least be interested in the Christian worldview. Let's start at the beginning, and I mean at the very beginning. The origin of the universe. Remember how I said every worldview answers the core questions of reality and the human condition? This would be right at the core of a worldview, namely, where did the world itself come from? How did the material universe get here? In a debate on BBC Radio in 1948, Frederick Copleston, the Christian philosopher, was debating Bertrand Russell, and he asked him the question, well, how did the universe get here? To which Russell replied, I should say that the universe is just there, and that's all. Just there, a brute fact of nature. Well, 75 years later, we know that this is not an adequate explanation for the origin of the universe. The universe is not just there, but had a beginning about 13.7 billion years ago, a beginning of space, time, matter, and energy. And in fact, you could really describe the historical sciences of the 20th century as really a revulsion against the Big Bang theory. That is to say that scientist after scientist from a naturalistic persuasion repeatedly called the Big Bang things like this: repugnant, preposterous, philosophically unacceptable, that it would betray the very foundations of science, that it was a crackpot theory. That's from Fred Hoyle. He actually gave the name Big Bang to the Big Bang theory. It's kind of funny. He called it crackpot theory, then called it the Big Bang. Anyways, strange conclusion. And then Jeffrey Burbidge says that his fellow naturalistic scientists are running off with, quote, evangelical fervor, end quote, to the, quote, first church of Christ of the Big Bang. Yes, this was threatening. To believe that the universe was just there and then to discover that the universe had a space, time, matter, and energy beginning. And since then, even though that this was barricaded, this was pushed against for the last 100 years, the evidence has come in from multiple different directions. In fact, what we've seen is that the Big Bang, the standard Friedmann-Lemaître model, the standard cosmological theory, has been proven and proven and proven over and over and over. What are we to make of this? Well, this is so demonstrable in cosmology and physics that Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose of Oxford University write this: almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Alexander Vilenkin, who is an agnostic cosmologist out of Tufts University, as an aside, I'm not going to quote to you tonight from any Christians, and I'm not going to quote to you tonight from any believers in God. Every citation I'm going to give you is either an agnostic or an atheist. So I'm kind of climbing into the ring here with both arms tied behind my back, but I'm just trying to give you the science or the atheistic view on the subject. So Vilenkin, who's colleagues with Arvind Bord and Alan Guth, he said this in 2006. It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even unreasonable men. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. Then more recently, in 2012, all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. And again, regarding other cosmological theories, none of these scenarios can actually be past eternal. And again, in 2015, we have no viable models of an eternal universe. The Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem gives reason to believe that such models simply cannot be constructed. The evidence is in, and it's overwhelmingly in favor that the universe had a beginning. Enter Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow's book, The Grand Design, in 2010, in which they seek to explain how the universe could spring into being from nothing. They open up the book, and page 5, they write, "Philosophy is dead." Now, right off the bat, they're not off to a good start. "Philosophy has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly in physics. Scientists have become bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. So the scientists have replaced the philosophers. Philosophy is dead." What's interesting is, in their central thesis on page 180, to describe the origin of the universe from nothing, they make no less than 3 philosophical blunders. So philosophy isn't dead, it's just being ignored, apparently. Here's what they write. "Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing." Now let's start with that first clause. "Because there is a law of gravity." "Is" in the English language is the word of being, and it's in the present tense, because there currently is a law of gravity. Gravity cannot exist apart from nature. Think about that for a second. Physical laws exist within nature, within the physical universe, but they do not exist apart from nature. That's like saying we have grammar without words and sentences. It's like saying we have rules to Monopoly without Monopoly. The rules make no sense. These can't exist apart from nature. What about the second sentence, or second clause? "The universe can and will create itself." Folks, this is metaphysically absurd. An effect cannot be its own cause. An effect cannot be its own cause. It makes perfect sense to say that X will and can create Y. It makes no sense to say that X can and will create X. For in order to create X, X has to already exist, but that's the thing that X is creating. And so this is metaphysically absurd that the universe, as one philosopher put it, can pull itself up by its cosmic bootstraps. And then finally, the universe was created out of nothing. Now, this is where it gets really deep philosophically. Do you know what the word nothing means? It's a noun. It means no thing, not anything, non-existence, non-being, universal negation. Nothing is what Justin Bieber writes songs about. That's what nothing is. Nothing means no thing. They have redefined the word nothing to describe something. Could you imagine if Christians were this loose with the definitions in their scientific literature? Could you even imagine that? To say that nothing is actually something? They refer back to chapter 6 in their book, where they say that nothing is actually a quantum fluctuation, a quantum field. But a quantum field is not nothing. Do you know what a quantum vacuum is? It is a broiling, burbling sea of energy. It is very unstable, where, you know, subatomic particles jump out of the quantum vacuum and then recede within a trillionth of a second. And a quantum field or vacuum cannot exist forever. So let's just grant that the universe came from a quantum vacuum and that space-time started and collapsed back into a quantum vacuum. This itself would need a beginning, which they admit. This is guilty of equivocation. That's where you're using one word in two different senses. Like if I said, "You don't know what time is, define time for me." And you said, "Well, I know what time is, it's a magazine." That really hit it off in philosophy class. Apparently, one person kind of applauded. Nothing means nothing. And even if this is true, it would still demand a beginning. So this leaves us with the contention that nothing created something. That is an extraordinary claim. Absolutely extraordinary. That claim is more extraordinary than any miracle I have ever read in the Bible. Any of them. Because at least in the Bible, when you have a miracle claim, whether it's a virgin birth or people going through a parted sea, at least you have an infinite personal God who can do miracles. Here, you have no one who can do miracles. Now, as extravagant as this is not the claim that's being made. The claim is not that nothing created something. The claim is that nothing created everything that we see. Far more implausible. And if you could believe that, that nothing can create something. I've heard some people say, oh, that's really deep. It's not deep. It's a contradiction. It's metaphysically absurd. If you could believe that, then you can believe anything. What is the best explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe? Since about 1974, Brandon Carter, who is a physicist, discovered that the laws, constants, and initial conditions of the universe are exquisitely, infinitesimally, finely tuned for the possibility of life to exist. So this research over about 40 to close to 50 years has come in decade by decade by decade to discover that the universe lies on a hair's breadth. Who believes in this? Everybody. Everyone from Oxford University to Stanford University and everywhere in between. These are all atheistic or agnostic academicians who are at the top of their class, top of their field, doing research in physics and cosmology. And each one of them demonstrates the fine-tuning problem. And to this list, we could also add Richard Dawkins from The God Delusion. Now, the book is called The God Delusion, so we know he's not going to go easy on us here. He says that physicists have calculated that if the laws and constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been, and here's the key word, impossible. Impossible. Not that if you changed gravity just a little bit, instead of being a little over 6 foot tall, I would be a little over 8 foot tall and would help my NBA prospects. Of course, LeBron James would be 10 foot tall, so that wouldn't help. My point is, it's not that it would just change things a little bit. It's that life would cease to be. Life would not be possible if you started fuddling with the values of these constants and laws and initial conditions. Now, to be fair, there is one scientist out there at the University of Texas. His name is Dr. Ian Malcolm, who disagrees, so I think we could play this clip here.
It's not possible. Listen, if there's one thing the history of evolution has taught us, it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, it expands to new territories, and it crashes through barriers painfully, maybe even dangerously, but life finds a way.
I show that clip for two reasons. One, I think it's hilarious. Two, I really like Jeff Goldblum a lot. So and people are like, even in The Fly by David Cronenberg? Yes, even in The Fly by David Cronenberg. I think he's amazing. Anyways, that's not even our topic for tonight. Now, some people have said, well, maybe we're thinking too narrowly about this concept of fine-tuning. Like, you're thinking of carbon-based life? Well, what if there was silicon-based life? You know, some other element combining with hydrogen. Well, let's think about that for a second. When you think about hydrogen, this is the most abundant element in the universe. So this would be the element against which you'd want to have chemical compounds with the other elements on the periodic table. And as you view this, you start to see that different elements can create different chemical compounds. So lithium has 4, beryllium 6, nitrogen 65. Silicon, which is closest on the periodic table to carbon, has 55 chemical compounds with hydrogen. Let's compare this with carbon. Carbon and hydrogen can make over 29,000 chemical compounds. Let me just give you an example. CO2, one part carbon, two parts oxygen. That creates carbon dioxide, yes? If you were to replace carbon with silicon and one part silicon and two parts oxygen, you wouldn't have carbon dioxide, you'd actually have sand, a crystal. So people who say, well, maybe we could have a different form of life, I don't think you're quite grasping here. If you're saying that, that's only adding to the improbability which we're describing, not subtracting from it. And really, as we study this subject of fine-tuning, what we're seeing is that this would actually wipe out the periodic table. What are we talking about here? Let me give you just a few examples. The ratio of electrons to protons in the universe. This is finely tuned to one part in 10 raised to the 36th power. That's a 1 with 36 zeros after it. Some people are like, well, maybe if you know it's a little bit different, life would have evolved a different way. No, we wouldn't have galaxies, we wouldn't have stars, we wouldn't have planets. Well, maybe evolution could have gone a different... No galaxies, no stars, no planets, nothing to evolve upon. The N constant, this is electromagnetism to gravity. These are two of the fundamental forces of physics. This is tuned to one part in 10 to the 37th power. If it was increased a little bit, no small stars, which we need a small star to have a slow burn to allow for an equitable, habitable planet. We need large stars in order to seed the galaxy with the heavier elements. No life. The gravitational constant put against the weak force, another of the four fundamental forces of nature. This is tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 50th. If it was larger, no galaxies. If it was smaller, the universe would have collapsed. Now, I know I threw a bunch of numbers at you there, and I know those numbers are incommensurably high, 10 to the 50, 10 to the 37th. Let's think about this for a second. The force of gravity is G multiplied by M1, the object of one mass of one object, multiplied by M2, the mass of another object, divided by the radius squared between the two objects. So M1 could be the sun, and M2 could be the moon. Or M1 could be the Earth, and M2 could be Jupiter. You could change M1 and M2, and you could change the radius, the distance between the two squared. Those can all change. But the gravitational constant is the only thing that stays the same. And this is finely tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 40th power. That is to say, this is a 1 followed by 40 zeros after it. That's how accurate this needs to be. Let's say later tonight, you're feeling very lucky and you go to pick up your ticket for the Powerball. You want to retire and have your kids retire and have their kids retire. $200 million, baby. Well, what is the chances of you winning the Powerball? This is 1 in 300 million. That doesn't even come close to the gravitational constant. Well, what about the number of cells in the human body? What if a doctor said, we can cure you, but we have to pull out one cell blindfolded at random, and if we pull out the right cell, you'll live? Well, that would be 1 chance in 37 trillion. How many of you would sign up for that operation? Well, what about the number of seconds that the universe has existed? Let's say that we quantify the age of the universe, 13.7 billion years, into seconds. How many seconds would that be? That would be 10 to the 18th number of seconds. That's the accuracy you would need. So this isn't even getting close. Now, I don't want you to be, I know a lot of us, like myself, weren't really into math when we were in high school. I know a lot of us look at that, 18, 10 to the 18, that's about half of 10 to the 40. No, these are exponents, people. 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 19th is 10 times 10 to the 18th. 10 to the 20th is 100 times. 10 to the 40th, that is all the way out in the parking lot. Let's see if we can come up with a better illustration here. Let's say that we had a God's eye view of the entire material universe. And just because we're imagining, let's say that we had a God-sized Stanley tape measure at one end of the universe. And we stretched this across the entire breadth of the universe. And we broke up the universe into inches. The gravitational constant could not be 1 inch weaker, or there would be no life, life prohibiting. It could not be 1 inch stronger, or there would be no life, life prohibiting. It needs to have the Goldilocks effect. Not too soft, not too strong, not too hot, not too cold, just right. Now you might say, well, that is absolutely improbable. This is only 10 to the 28 inches. This isn't even coming close to what we're describing here tonight. Now, I've talked to some people and they said, well, yeah, but you're saying it's 1 part in 10 to the 40th power. Yes. So you're saying there is a chance. I'm like, dude, that kind of reminds me of this movie I used to like.
That's more like 1 out of 1 million.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
Yeah! We laughed at that movie. Why? Why did we laugh at that scene? Because what is the redhead saying? There's no chance of us ever getting together. But he just can't get it through his mind. And we laughed at that. 1 in 1 million, that's funny. What if she said 1 part in 10 to the 40th power? We would have been wetting our pants with laughter. No, chance cannot account for this. And this isn't even the worst of it. The lambda constant, the cosmological constant, this is tuned to 1 part in 10 raised to the 120th power. That's 120 zeros. This figure is 0.000, 120 zeros, and then a 2. If it was any larger, the universe would be a hydrogen and helium soup. Not propitious for life, to say the least. Just filled with hydrogen. With all that helium, we'd be talking really high all the time, too. And that'd be embarrassing. So, how about the low entropy of the universe? Roger Penrose calculates this to 10 to the 10 raised to the 123rd power. Did you know that if we were to write out the zeros, according to Penrose, and we were to write a zero on every subatomic particle in the universe, That's 10 to the 80th subatomic particles. We wouldn't have enough zeros to write this number. Penrose says we'd fall way short just to write the number of the low entropy of the universe. All in all, we have somewhere between 30 and 50 laws, constants, and initial conditions. So what is the best explanation for this? That we got really, really lucky. That we hit the cosmic jackpot here. Or could it be, what could explain fine-tuning? I don't know, let me think for a second. It seems like you'd need like a fine-tuner. That would explain it. A being which would be transcendent of nature, outside of nature, because if it was in nature, then it would be subject to the fine-tuning itself. It would have to be outside of nature, incredibly powerful, incredibly intelligent, and to have life in mind. It could even imply that he could see us coming. Well, number three, what is the best explanation for objective morality? Now, we're not talking about subjective morality. There's no question about that. Who cares? Subjective morality is my taste, my opinion, my preference. There's no dispute about that. We're talking about objective morality. Objective is in the sense that it's true whether I believe it or not. Years ago, I had a friend who was talking to a young agnostic student who he was friends with, and they were kind of talking back and forth, and he discovered that his friend was a moral subjectivist, a moral relativist. He didn't believe that morality is really objectively true. And so my buddy said, well, wait a minute, what about murder? Murdering someone for fun, you don't think that's objectively wrong? Then his friend, the relativist, said, well, I mean, I wouldn't murder anybody. I wouldn't want to do that. I'm not into murder, but, you know, maybe for somebody else, they think that that's right. And who am I to say? He said, well, what about the Holocaust? 6 million Jews killed, gas chamber. And the friend started to wince. I mean, he just really started to tighten up. Oh, I mean, if I was a Hitler youth, I probably would have thought that it was right if I was living at that time. So my friend's like, rapid fire. All right, the Crusades. He's just like, I don't know. Inquisition. I don't know. So finally, my friend is African-American, and he hits him with a nuclear bomb. He says, dude, slavery? And this poor guy, his face contorted. I mean, he was like worked up, breathing. It looked like he was trying to pass a kidney stone. You know, he's just like sweating. And my buddy's just like, dude, why are you wincing? It's clear. You know that it's... And finally, he's like, all right, I believe it. I believe it's true. Okay. Objective morality. If there is such a thing, what could explain it? Well, atheistic philosophers and thinkers have offered a number of different explanations for this. Walter Sinnott Armstrong, atheistic philosopher, he just says it's a brute fact. There just is an objective moral law. He says there is just plain morality. What's immoral about causing serious harms to other people without justification? But now it seems natural to answer. It simply is, objectively. Don't you agree? Well, of course we agree. That's what we're trying to explain, Walter. That's what we're trying to describe. It's like me coming home from vacation and my grass is cut and the trash is taken out, and I'm like, what could explain this? And someone's like, well, it just simply is cut, objectively. Don't you agree? Yes, it's not a bad explanation. It's not a good explanation. It's no explanation. David Hume and A.J. Ayer, a logical positivist of the 20th century, argued that morality is really just contained to our emotions. So Hume said that vice and virtue are the object of feeling, not of reason. It lies in yourself, not in the object. Well, this would be a good case in point, not for objective morality. Not when we say that torture is wrong, I'm not saying that it just makes my skin crawl. I don't like it. I'm saying there's something wrong about that thing happening out there, the object. And this is just explicitly admitting, well, there is no such thing. It's a matter of your feelings. That's all. Other people argue that evolution can give an account for objective morality. To this, we would just have to simply point out the definition of evolution. Evolution means change over time. So for someone to say that evolution brought about morality, this is not objective morality, because objective morality does not change over time. It deals with the object out there, not with subjective impulses in here. Yes, it's argued that we could have certain impulses because of cooperative behavior and reciprocity and troop behavior, but this would just give us impulses that would change over time, and they could have gone any other different direction. So this is not objective in the least. Evolution is a descriptive process. It does not prescribe anything. What about reason? Some people say, well, we just come up with good reasons for morality. Think about that for a second. Now, you need reason to do moral thinking. Reason is necessary for morality, but it's not sufficient. Like, it's necessary to have gas in my car to drive across town, but I need a car. The gas itself isn't sufficient to get me across town. Reason is necessary to do science, but reason is not the same as science, and reason is not the same as morality. Because even though you have reasons to do such and such a thing, that does not mean that you have obligations to do that thing. Somebody might say, well, I'll give you a reason to come over and do this, $200. Yes, that's a good reason, but I'm not morally obligated to do so. Atheistic philosopher Kai Nielsen wrote this. He said, we have not been able to show that reason requires the moral point of view, or that all really rational persons shouldn't be individual egoists or classical moralists. Reason doesn't decide here. The picture I have painted for you is not a pleasant one. Reflection on it depresses me. Pure, practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to morality. Reason cannot account for it. Other people say culture or law, that perhaps we just have a cultural consensus, and whatever the culture thinks, that cultural consensus becomes what's moral and immoral. Paul Kurtz, who's an atheistic philosopher, says the moral principles that govern our behavior are rooted in, what's their foundation? What's their grounding? What are they rooted in? What explains them? They're rooted in habit and custom, feeling and fashion. So whatever is the cultural zeitgeist, you know, whatever the fashion is at the time, that's being equated with morality here, according to Kurtz. So in other words, morality is just cultural taboo. It's like wearing white socks with a tuxedo. It's like belching loudly at the dinner table. I'd like to show you a picture of a cultural taboo, and it's a little bit disgusting, okay, maybe even downright horrific. If you have young children in the room, you might want to have them not look, all right? It's a picture of me when I was 13 years old, all right? And this is it. Oh! Did somebody say aw? Is that what you said? Don't encourage him for what he's doing. Look at me, I was 13. I was pale, I was skinny, I had these big bug eyes that stuck out of my head. I was constantly sweating, I was like slimy. I looked like I was on a perpetual mission to get the ring back from Frodo. Look at that face. Only a mother could love. Oh. But look at what I'm wearing in this picture. This is in the heat of summer. I got a denim button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled up past the elbows to show off my delicate forearms, with a watch on the wrong hand, and my hair delicately gelled and parted in the middle like alfalfa. Look at that again. That's just terrible. It's just awful. That's cultural taboo. Now, you'd say all those things I'm wearing, you're like, people didn't dress like that. I know. I was breaking cultural taboo. I didn't learn how to dress myself until I got married. I mean, it's really bad. If this is the case, that really what we're saying is that morality is equivalent to cultural taboo, breaking taboos, then what we're tacitly admitting is that there is no such thing as moral progress. All you have is moral change. Moral progress, like abolition, women's suffrage, child labor laws. To say that these were moral progresses is to say that there is a standard outside of culture toward which we're moving. But if you don't have a standard, you don't have moral progress, you just have moral change. Under this view, it would follow that there are no such thing as moral reformers. Tonight, we were about to have Dr. John Perkins up on this stage. He is a genuine moral reformer. I saw him speak back in 2006 in Indianapolis, and it changed my life. Under this view, a moral reformer like Dr. Perkins wouldn't be a reformer appealing to a transcendent law outside of culture. He would be considered a moral deviant within the culture. Because if morality comes from culture and someone opposes that morality, then by definition, they themselves are immoral. This would mean that there are no such thing as immoral laws. Because, by definition, culture produces morality. But can you ever think of something that is immoral and yet is legal? Can you ever think about something in the history of the human race that was legal but immoral? Finally, what happens when cultures disagree? Did you know that at the Nuremberg trials, when the Nazis were being tried by the world government at the time, the world nations at the time, the Nazis appealed to this cultural relativism? They said that we are just conforming to our culture, and morality is really just conforming to the culture in which we find ourselves. Who are you to judge us from a different culture? And the justices there said, no, there is a law which is above the law. There is a transcendent moral law that goes over individual cultures. Other people say utilitarianism. This is the idea that whatever is good for the maximum amount of people is the good. Jeremy Bentham, who is the high priest of utilitarianism, philosopher, he says, natural rights is simple nonsense. Natural and imprescriptible rights, rhetorical nonsense. Nonsense upon stilts. Could you be any more clear, Jeremy? Under his view, what's good is what's good for the society. But to say that an individual has natural, inalienable human rights is simple nonsense, rhetorical nonsense, and nonsense upon stilts. In fact, this is the view of every totalitarian regime. It's the view of the worst dictator of our age. I'm speaking, of course, of Thanos from the Avengers. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And don't get to me about spoilers. It's been out for a year and a half. He throws his daughter over. Why? Because he had a utilitarian ethic. That what's good for the many is actually... And that's a really cool theme in that movie when you see the Avengers say, we don't trade lives for lives. Thanos says that we kill lives to save lives. Utilitarianism. Finally, there's the idea of the ideal social contract. This was developed by John Rawls. It's that we come up with an ideal contract for society, and we put a veil of ignorance over the moral ethicist. And so you don't know if you're going to be rich or poor, what ethnicity, which gender, which part of the sociological strata, and you have to decide what's right in the world based on this veil of ignorance. Does that result in objective morality? My question would be, who stands behind the veil of ignorance? Now, somebody would say, well, it's just a hypothetical question. So we're going to let a hypothetical person determine morality for us. How does that make sense? Well, it's an individual. Well, if it's an individual, then why is what they say binding upon me? A contract implies that both people bilaterally sign the contract. If it's truly objective, then what if I don't sign the contract? No, this would be good in discovering morality, but not as a ground for morality. And so, just to make this really simple, do you believe that morality came from matter and motion and molecules? How is that possible? Or do you believe that morality came from a mind, that God, as the source in his nature of morality, exists? That would make sense of a transcendent moral law. Finally, free will. What makes sense of free will? We live every day with it. Again, this is at the core of our worldview. This isn't something on the periphery. What you do with free will is going to affect every aspect of your life. When we think about this, if everything in the universe is determined by physics and chemistry, is that true? Yes, natural law would govern the universe. Then this would imply that our thoughts and intentions and decisions are also likewise determined. Unless you believe there's something beyond nature, like a soul or a mind, not just a brain, but a mind outside of the natural order. Here's Jerry Coyne on this.
Now, many of you probably don't accept that. You don't believe that your robot's made out of meat, which is what I'm going to try to convince you of today. But I just want you to think about it, okay? We have no more free will than a bowl of sugar. And I firmly believe that, because we are bowls of sugar, just very complicated ones. And we have nucleotides and proteins as well.
Well, I'm not going to invite him to my kid's birthday party. What a beautiful little meat machine you produced out of your womb. Wow. Thanks for coming, Jerry. A meat machine. You have no more free will than a bowl of sugar. Interesting. I firmly believe that. I want you to think about it. I just want you to think about it, and yet you don't have free will. This is the consensus view in naturalism today. Free will is called an illusion, a useful illusion, a grand illusion, an overwhelmingly powerful illusion. Here's my question. If free will is an illusion, then who is being deluded? Let me repeat that. If free will is an illusion, who is being deluded? You know, it would make sense for someone to do one of those magic eye pictures to me, or refract light, or do something to me that makes me think I'm seeing things. But an illusion presupposes that there's someone thinking and seeing. You can only be deluded if you have free will. There's further problems with this view. Number of problems with determinism. For one, mental states like thoughts are an illusion. You might think that you're having thoughts, but that's just brain gas. You know, one person might fizz like a bottle of Dr. Pepper. Another person might fizz like a bottle of Mountain Dew. And yet these thoughts are just products of our brain. And so these are an illusion under determinism. Reason, therefore, would be an illusion. Being able to put thoughts together into arguments and trying to assess which one is true, you are determined which one that you choose. So it would be nonsense to say that, well, I'm trying to convince you of determinism because you were determined to believe in it or not. Morality is an illusion because ought or should implies can. If you're just a meat machine carrying out its programming, well, then why would you hold a person responsible? That'd be like holding a computer responsible for malfunctioning. Lifelong identity is an illusion. Think about it like this. If all we are is physical beings, that means that our physical bodies are changing moment by moment, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, year by year. The physical parts of our bodies are being replaced constantly. So as a 9-pound, 13-ounce baby, true story, I was born, that is a different person than I am today. Because I have many different cells and chemical parts and juices and liquids and skin and everything else. So you would have to say that wasn't me who was born. It was a lookalike. Furthermore, in the future, to say that, well, I'm really worried about this operation in the future or going to the dentist in the future. Why are you worried? You won't be there when you get there. It'll be someone who looks like you, who has a lot of the same parts. So let's think about this for a second. Mental states are an illusion. Reason is an illusion. Morality, an illusion. Lifelong identity is an illusion. Or is it that philosophical naturalism is the illusion? How about that? Remember I said the most dangerous worldviews are the ones which we assume, not that are argued for. Have you ever heard a good argument that only nature exists? What I provided to you here were a number of arguments that there is something outside of nature. But just to affirm nature and nothing else, well, that would have to be defended. You couldn't just assume that. You'd need to prove it. Well, let's close up here tonight. What makes more sense to you? That nothing created everything? That we just hit the cosmic jackpot? That molecules created morality? That our thoughts, our reason, and our intuition are all an illusion? Or does it make more sense to you that something created everything? That a fine tuner tuned the universe? That morality came from a moral being, namely God, and that there's a reason that we have free will because we've been made in the image of a free moral being. As we conclude tonight, I want to be very clear about something. It's very easy when you start to think about these questions to have this turn into some kind of a volleyball, an intellectual game, some kind of a debate, and it's me against you. And that's not what I'm here for tonight. What I'm here to tell you is that there's good reasons to believe in the God of the Bible. But more than that, I'm here to tell you that He loves you more than you can possibly fathom. He has a deep and a fierce love for you. And I would be remiss if we concluded tonight without sharing with you that it's not just that this God exists, but this God did the unthinkable. The God who created the Milky Way, which has 100 billion galaxies, and there's 100 billion galaxies in the universe, that God condescended into the form of a person, Jesus of Nazareth, and he was tortured, he was whipped, and he was strung up like a butchered animal on a cross. And he did this for you. God died for you. And if you're here tonight and you've never heard that, let me just say, in order to take the next step here, it's not to start to debate, start to argue. The next step here is to have a personal interaction with a God who loves you. So just open up your heart here tonight. We're going to pray in a little bit. Open up your heart and just say, God, if you're here, I want to come to know you. I want to come and meet with you. I remember praying that prayer in May of 2004. I woke up the next day thinking there'd be some kind of a cloud. You know, James, I love you in the sky, nothing like that. 5 months later, I met Brian Runk, that guy who insulted me and introduced me earlier. Instead of giving me a sign, God gave me a credible, Christ-like, knowledgeable Christian to answer all my questions, to be patient with me, to love me, and to care for me. And maybe that's why God has you here tonight as well.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.